Welcome to News Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Robert Morgan, of course, a native of North Carolina Mountains, most admired author of wonderful books, fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, and now for more than 40 years a professor at Cornell University. I'm sharing him with you because a few weeks ago we started talking about the American Revolution and particularly how it was fought in the last years in the American South. And Robert Morgan convinced me that that might be the most interesting war stories that overpower those from the Civil War or even from World War I and World War II. So I'm anxious to share him with you, and he's agreed to visit us. He's up in Ithaca at Cornell right now. Robert Morgan, can I call you Bob, or what do you...
Just call me Bob. That'll be fine.
Are you sure? Thanks for doing this. We already miss you in North Carolina. Hope things are cooler up there in Ithaca.
It is very cool this morning, in fact.
You've written not just fiction and poetry, but you've also written history. And you and I have talked about your wonderful biography of Daniel Boone and also your great book about the most interesting personalities in the opening of the West. I was surprised when I visited with you how much you seemed to know and love the stories of the American Revolution, particularly as it took place in our region. And you persuaded me. Laura, let me just ask you this question. Did the war, as it took place in the Carolinas in 1780 and 1781, is that what broke the back of the British commitment to keep the Americans under their control?
Yes, in the popular imagination, the revolution is in the Northeast. Of course, it's Lexington, Concord, Bunker Hill, and then Saratoga in 1777. But yes, the war actually ended in the South in about a half a dozen battles, beginning in the fall of Charleston in May of 1780. I got really interested in this history when I was researching the novel Brave Enemies that came out in 2003. That novel culminates at the Battle of Cowpens in January of 1781. But I grew up hearing these stories. My dad was a wonderful storyteller. He was a history buff, and he loved to talk about the Battle of Kings Mountain and the Battle of Cowpens, only about 35 miles away from where I grew up. And I knew that at least four of my ancestors had fought in the Battle of Cowpens. So I was always interested in it, but I really started doing research when I was writing the novel Brave Enemies about the Cowpens campaign and the victory of Daniel Morgan. And it turned out I am distantly related to Daniel Morgan.
Is that right? No. Is distantly related straight down, or he's an uncle or a great-great-great-great-great-uncle?
No, I'm not descended from him, but it's the same connection as with Daniel Boone. We all have a common ancestor way back in North Wales called Lou Ellen App Morgan.
My golly.
Daniel Boone was descended from him, and Daniel Morgan also, and my line of Morgan.
Well, what set it up for us? You mentioned the Battle of Cowpens, and of course, as I remember, that was a great victory for the Patriot cause. But what had happened to set it up in the colonial forces had not been doing so well? What was going on with what were the British objectives in South Carolina in 1780 or maybe a little 1779? What was going on?
What had happened in the Revolution was that after the great battles of Saratoga in September and October of 1777. The war kind of came to a standstill. There was some fighting, I think the Battle of Monmouth in New Jersey, but Clinton, the overall commander, was headquartered there in New York, and Washington was unable to dislodge him. And the war came to a kind of stalemate. The British were very frustrated. The Americans were frustrated. Nobody seemed to know how to bring it to an end. And Clinton, almost in desperation, decided he would launch a campaign from the South. And they first went to Savannah, I believe in late 1779. And Cornwallis and his army then in the spring of 1780 attacked Charleston, which was held by General Benjamin Lincoln. They took Charleston. It was a humiliating defeat for the American forces. Cornwallis then was left in command of Charleston.
What was their idea? Why did they want to start with Charleston?
Well, they were afraid of a French invasion, and Charleston was the major port in the South, perhaps the major port actually in the country, and that would be a natural place for the French to land a big army. So Cornwallis's orders were to hold Charleston and Savannah against a French invasion. But once Clinton was going back to New York, Cornwallis had the idea pretty much on his own that he could invade the Carolina backcountry, go up the river in South Carolina, subdue South Carolina, then subdue North Carolina, reinstall colonial governors, march into Virginia, cut off Washington's southern support, and bring the revolution to an end. So he started this new campaign of invading the Carolina backcountry.
What was the situation in the backcountry? This had been pretty much out of British control, and so were the people there supportive of the revolution, or did they welcome Cornwallis when he came back, or when he brought British control back to parts of the backcountry?
Well, there was a lot of Tory support in the South Carolina backcountry, and also. Supportive of the American cause. It was divided. It was a very contentious and violent time, neighbor against neighbor, brother against brother. But Cornwallis assumed there was a lot of support for the British cause in Carolina, and that's one reason he thought he could be successful, marching into that country, putting down rebellion. And he marched upriver at Camden, South Carolina, in August of 1780, he totally defeated the Americans under General Horatio Gates. It was such a humiliating defeat that Gates rode away in one day, all the way from Camden to Charlotte, and then in two more days, all the way to Hillsborough, North Carolina, ostensibly to reorganize his army, but he became the laughingstock because he had fled and his army had disintegrated.
Well, he was a hero, wasn't he? He was a hero, wasn't he, from other battles in the...
He was thought of as the victor at Saratoga, but we now know that that the generals who won those battles, there were two battles at Saratoga in the fall of 1777, were more won by Benedict Arnold, of all people, and Colonel Morgan of the Virginia Rifles, Daniel Morgan, the man at Cowpens. Much of those battles, Horatio Gates was not even present. He was in his tent or somewhere. So he probably wasn't that great a general even at Saratoga, but he certainly proved to be a total failure.
Why did he lose at Camden? And was he fighting directly against Cornwallis at this point, or who was on the other side?
He was fighting Cornwallis that had marched up the river, and it was Cornwallis. And it's not as though Cornwallis, was so brilliant there. It's just that Gates made every mistake possible, historians have said. And if he had tried to lose the battle, he couldn't have done any worse. He attacked, from the wrong direction at the wrong time. Everything was off.
What was the composition of the troops? Were these on the British side, British regulars or Hessians, or were they Tory people from South Carolina who fell in the fight? And on the other side,
it was mostly British regulars. It was the best army in the world. And Cornwallis was a good commander. He wasn't an absolute brilliant general, but he was certainly competent. He also had some Tory militia, and he had the Green Dragoons and Legion under Lieutenant Colonel Bannister Tarleton, a formidable cavalry commander who never took prisoners. Tarleton, it was the fear of people on the American side because he killed everybody. And
that's his reputation.
In the movie,
Is that right? Was he really that way, or was this sort of rumors that couldn't be substantiated? Or was Tarleton really, was he that bad a guy?
He killed everybody. He didn't take prisoners, and he bragged that he had raped more than 20 women in South Carolina. He burned, he looted. He has a very bad reputation in South Carolina. Right up there with Sherman, shall we say. Now, he was conducting a campaign of terror to subdue the Carolina backcountry.
It's interesting because you and others have said that Cornwallis himself was a gentlemanly person. Did he order this conduct by Tarleton, or did he just overlook it, or what? What was their relationship, and what was did Cornwallis have responsibility for what Tarleton was doing?
Cornwallis was so furious that this rebellion could not be put down that he forgot his gentlemanly restraints, I think, in that campaign. He encouraged Tarleton. In the movie The Patriot, the Cornwallis figure rebukes the person who's based on Tarleton, but that never happened. We have the letters between them. We know that he praised Tarleton for his depredations. They wanted so badly to intimidate the colonies so they would finally give up this rebellion, that they were willing to do things they might not have done otherwise.
I'm visiting with Robert Morgan. We're talking about the American Revolution, and particularly about it in the South, and to what extent the actions in the South towards the end of the war really made the difference. And he and I, Robert Morgan, I'll be right back after the short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is Robert Morgan, famous and beloved author from North Carolina, but currently and for the last 40 years or so, a beloved professor at Cornell University in Ithaca. From there, he's visiting with us, and we're talking about the American Revolution. Robert Morgan seems to know more about that than anybody I've talked to lately. And Bob Morgan, you were talking a little bit about how the colonial forces had suffered a tremendous defeat at the hands of General Cornwallis at Camden Courthouse. And so it looked like, you described the American General Gates as running away, leaving his troops behind, desperate to get to Hillsborough. And it looked like maybe Cornwallis's idea of stomping out the revolution in the South was going to work. What was the situation after Camden Courthouse?
Well, Cornwallis was buoyed up by this victory. He assumed this campaign was going to go well, and he marched all the way to Charlotte and began preparations to install a new royal governor of North Carolina. But he had appointed Patrick Ferguson, Major Patrick Ferguson, a Scotsman, whom he did not like and who really did not like Tarleton. He appointed Ferguson to raise a militia in South Carolina to attack the backcountry in North Carolina and South Carolina. And Ferguson was very successful at doing that. He raised 4,000 Tory militia and was attacking.
These were people who lived in North and South Carolina and maybe North Carolina, and these were people who, Americans, who did not support the revolution. They were ready to go to war against the American forces.
Exactly. There was, as I said earlier, a lot of support for the Tory cause in the Carolinas. However, the depredations, the violence of Tarleton's campaign began to turn public opinion against the British. That is, Cornwallis and Tarleton's campaign had exactly the opposite effect from what they had planned. They thought it would intimidate people, and instead it stirred them up to oppose. So Ferguson found himself in some battles against these backcountry people, and he's very angry. He knew that Isaac Shelby across the mountains had led skirmishes against him, and he sent a message to the Overmountain men on the Holston River and the Watauga River that if you don't quit harassing me and my people, I'll come over and destroy you. Well, this was not the kind of thing to say to Isaac Shelby and John Sevier, and they gathered up militias and marched across the mountains to Quaker Meadows, that's Morganton, North Carolina, and joined some South Carolina militia and some North Carolina militia, and marched on Ferguson, who had, strangely enough, camped out on the top of Kings Mountain in South Carolina.
It seems like at the top of the mountain would be a good place because you could defend yourself from almost anybody. They'd have to climb up steep mountains to get to you.
Well, it was a good place if the battle did not last very long, but you see, there was no water up there. And once Shelby and Campbell and Sevier and their men surrounded the mountain, they couldn't get off to get supplies, to be resupplied. And there was only one little spring further down. So in that, hot weather, it was in October of 1780, they soon ran out of water. And it was a battle of attrition. There were slightly more American militia than Tory militia. And, of course, we all know what happened. They actually surrounded it, closed in, and killed Ferguson, and killed a lot of people trying to surrender. Now, Cornwallis at Charlotte did not come to Ferguson's aid, and Tarleton did not come to his aid.
Why not?
They didn't like this Scotsman. He was too independent. He was hot-tempered. He was not an English gentleman.
Well, are you suggesting that they just let him be defeated because they didn't like him and let the Americans win this important battle?
They probably would have said they didn't want to risk their men in support of this militia. They had regular troops. They had these really well-trained troops. And so for whatever reason, they did not come to his aid. But this great victory at Kings Mountain in October of 1780 shook Cornwallis so much that he withdrew to Winnsboro, South Carolina.
You had mentioned earlier he was at this point in Charlotte, hoping to reconstitute the royal government, and then, as you hint, I think that almost because he didn't like the Scottish commander at King's Mountain, he let him be defeated. But that defeat itself was, Cornwallis then realized that was a pretty important thing, and he retreated, didn't he?
I don't think he had realized that opposition was so strong in the Carolinas. I mean, this had happened between the Battle of Camden in August and October, that I think a lot of the people who had been either neutral or perhaps even sympathetic to the British, because of the actions of Tarleton and maybe Ferguson himself, the chemistry had changed, or had begun to change. And Cornwallis knew taking North Carolina was not going to be as easy as he had assumed it would be. So he moved his army back. But he sent Tarleton out on these raids across Upper South Carolina and even into North Carolina, burning, looting, killing, raping. And
was this the time, at the time that Cornwallis was in Charlotte, was it, this the time that he is supposed to have said this is a, that Charlotte is a hornet's nest?
I believe so, yes, in Mecklenburg. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, all right, so now this is getting towards the end of 1780. The Patriots have won a bad, big battle at Kings Mountain, and Cornwallis has moved his forces back into South Carolina, away from the troubles of North Carolina. What happens next?
Okay, General Nathaniel Greene had been appointed by Congress in Washington to replace Horatio Gates. Greene is an excellent commander. He's from Rhode Island. He was a Quaker, actually. He's called the Fighting Quaker.
Mm.
And Colonel Daniel Morgan has been raised to Brigadier General to command a force to go into that backcountry where Bannister Tarleton is operating and looting and killing and intimidating people. Morgan's orders are to spirit up the people, to provide a presence, and to gather hog and hominy, among other things, to gather supplies. It's the new year now. It's January 1781. And about the 15th of January, Morgan comes to the Pacolet River. This is just east of Spartanburg, where Spartanburg would be. And looks across the river, and there is Tarleton and his Green Dragoons. And he has his legion, he has the 71st Highlanders, and Morgan knows he's in no condition to fight with Tarleton, because Morgan has over 300 Continental regulars from Delaware and Maryland, some Virginia militia, and some more ragtag militia from Georgia and North Carolina. He goes up the river that night of January 15th, camps, and Tarleton deceives him. He sends some people to go up the river on the opposite side and build big bonfires so that Morgan assumes that Tarleton is camping on the other side of the river at a ford, I think close to a place called Wofford's Ironworks. During the night, Tarleton crosses the river 6 miles downstream, and around 2 or 3 in the morning, scouts come into Morgan's camp yelling, "Tarleton is across the river, and he's coming for us." The Americans leave their breakfast. They leave their tents. They start running. They don't feel they're able to confront this very fine army that has never lost a battle. So they run all day north, trying to get to the Broad River and cross into North Carolina. But late in the afternoon, they reach the Broad River, and it's been raining and snowing in the mountains of North Carolina, and the river's in flood. They can't cross it. They don't have time to build rafts. They know they will be killed by Tarleton if they're trying to get across the river. So Morgan sends out messengers saying, "Meet me at the cowpens." Now, the cowpens were a pasture there in South Carolina where they gathered cattle and perhaps fattened them before sending to the markets in Columbia and Charleston. And he chooses the cowpens because everybody knows where it is. It had been the muster ground for the Kings Mountain men. So he moves his army back, I think it's about 5 miles, and they camp at the north end of this pasture, the cowpens. And all night, South Carolinians come in to join him. We don't know exactly how many people Morgan had because there's no roster of those people who came in during the night to join him. Now, Morgan knows these militia boys gathered there are terrified of a cavalry charge or a bayonet charge. They're just squirrel hunters. They're farmers, so they have rifles. They're good riflemen. But Tarleton has killed so many people who are running from him. He runs them down and chops them to pieces with these sharp cavalry sabers. And the same is true of the bayonet charge. These untrained soldiers don't know how to stand up to a bayonet charge. So Morgan walks among his men around the campfires that night, and he does two things. He jerks up his shirt and shows the scars where he was whipped for sassing a British officer in the French and Indian Wars, given 500 lashes. And he says, look what these blackguards did to me. They're going to kill us all if we don't fight them tomorrow.
I want to take a quick. I've got to take a quick break. We're right at the crisis moment. But I'm visiting with Robert Morgan. We're talking about the very important Battle of Cowpens, and it's just about to happen and will happen after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Bob Morgan, and he's telling us about the Battle of Cowpens. I interrupted him right at the moment where the colonial forces, who had tried to retreat, had to stay and fight the British. Robert Morgan, when we left it, the general who had a name similar to you was, I don't know whether it was General Morgan, Daniel Morgan, or whether it was the top American general, General Green, who was mustering his forces, but who was trying to keep the colonial forces?
Now, Green was farther east. He was down about Sherrill in South Carolina. So Morgan was on his own. But he did have Colonel Pickens of South Carolina with him. It's thought that that Francis Marion refused to join Morgan because he was jealous that Morgan had been promoted to brigadier general in the regular army, and he had not. He resented that. But the real stroke of genius, I think, on Morgan's part is he knew he was facing Tarleton the next morning, was that he told these militia boys they did not have to stand up to a cavalry charge or a bayonet charge, that he would form three lines. And each line would fire two or perhaps three shots and then run back to the next line. And then they would fire again at the British approaching them and then run back to the third line. He put the North Carolinians and the Georgians on the front line. He said, we'll see who are the better sharpshooters, the Georgians or the North Carolinians. And then the South Carolinians were on the second line, commanded by Pickens. And then he put the Delaware and Maryland regulars and the Virginia militia on the third line. Now, this took away a lot of the tension, I think, that these boys knew they didn't have to wait until that cavalry charge or the bayonet charge reached them. But Morgan also had an ace, which Tarleton apparently did not know about. He had the South Carolina cavalry under William Washington, and he hid that cavalry behind a pine grove over on his left flank so he could swing that out behind the British as they were attacking. This is called a double envelopment. And this is why the Battle of Cowpens is studied in military academies and in war colleges all over the world. Though it's not well known among the general public, it's one of the greatest tactical victories in American history.
Well, how did the victory come about? How did the victory come about? It sounds like the way you have it set up, you've got these ragtag Americans facing the best of the British army under the leadership of the, we can call him evil, mean-spirited,
but
very,
Carlson, yeah,
very talented officer. And you haven't mentioned it, but right behind them is the Broad River overflowing, so there's really no retreat path if the
British... They've got to win.
Yeah.
They've got to win.
How'd they do it?
Morgan had spirited them up so that they were ready. They were waiting as Tarleton came up the Green River Road. We think, between 7 and 8 in the morning. Say 7:45, something like that. And it worked as Morgan had planned it, at least at first. Those sharpshooters, squirrel hunters, started emptying the saddles of the officers and sergeants. Morgan had shouted, "Old Morgan was never beat." And he shouted, "Boys, hit the epaulets and stripes. That is, don't shoot the private soldiers. break this chain of command. This is very important because they emptied 15 saddles of the officers and sergeants at the very beginning. Now, these are well-trained soldiers who don't know what to do when their officers are killed and not with them. And these boys could also reload their rifles while they were running. They were so experienced at using these rifles. So they fire their two shots, or three shots, it's not clear which it is, and ran 150 yards back to the South Carolina line and turned and fired again. Now the cavalry attacks them, and many of them panic at that point.
This is the British cavalry is attacking them?
Is attacking them.
Where did they come from? They just came from behind the British lines or behind the infantry who were attacking?
No, they were right in front of them. Morgan said he knew how Tarleton would fight. He only used downright fighting. That means he just came at it. He was young and inexperienced and didn't know very much about flanking action. The leader of the 71st Highlanders, the Scotsman, was so frustrated by that he formed a flanking action on the American right on his own authority, pretty much against Tarleton's. So this happened a little bit later. The second line panics when those Green Dragoons are coming at them and start running off to the left. Morgan rides after them, and a lieutenant from North Carolina named Hughes runs after them and shouts, Morgan, we're all gone if you keep running. You've got to reform. Come back. Come back. And that's when Colonel William Washington springs his cavalry out from behind the pine grove and attacks Tarleton's cavalry from behind and panicked them. And they had to turn and fight this cavalry. So this gives Morgan and this Lieutenant Hughes time to reform these panicked militiamen back in the third line. Now the bayonets are charging them, and the 71st Highlanders are coming in this flanking action from the right. And Morgan shouts, or somebody shouts, we're not here. Refuse the flank, that is, turn the line to face the people coming in from the side. And these militia guys don't know that term. They think an order has been given to retreat. So they turn, and the whole line, including the Maryland and Delaware regulars, start moving back. And Morgan rides up and says, you know, what are you doing? Are you beaten? And John Eager Howard of the Maryland Delaware Regulars says, does it look like we're beaten? That is, we're retreating in good order. And Morgan shouts, okay, continue until I tell you to turn and fire. And they retreat up the hill a little bit. The British assume they have won. The British infantry assumes they have won. They're coming in for the kill with the bayonets. Morgan gives the order, and the whole American line turns and fires right into their face. And they panic. The British have never seen anything like that. And many of them are killed. Others fall and surrender. The whole field is so covered with smoke from rifles and from these small cannon the British had, 3-pound grasshoppers, they were called, that it's a rout. The British surrender, and Tarleton and his men start running, hoping to get back across the river and join Cornwallis.
And so do they.
He got away.
The Pacolet River was there back, so they were able to cross that river to get away?
He was riding farther south, and he crossed the Broad River further down.
Said that the Broad River was not crossable by the Patriots, but they were able to.
That was further north, right?
Right.
I think he may have actually gotten a ferry or something. He and his men got back. They played a trick. They got a woman to give the wrong directions about where they had gone. They said they would kill her husband if she told which direction they had gone. So Tarleton and his men, some of his men, a few of his men, actually did make it back to the camp further south. I mean, this is down toward Winnebago, South Carolina.
We're visiting with Robert Morgan, who's told us about how the Americans won the important Battle of Cowpens. We're going to take a quick break, and he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Robert Morgan. We're talking about the American Revolution in the South, and I'm panning as you describe the Battle of Cowpens, which was an important victory. What did Cowpens do for the American cause?
Oh, it along with the Kings Mountain gave so much courage to the Americans that these militias could defeat the finest army in the world in a battle like that. It was a total victory. Morgan had so many prisoners he didn't know what to do with them. It was a real job. And of course, Morgan was suffering from sciatica at that battle, and he was in such great pain that he had to retire from the field immediately after the Battle of Cowpens. Greene came and joined the men, Morgan's men, and they were moving away from Cornwallis, because Cornwallis started coming after them. He was coming up the river. But Cornwallis had lost so many of his cavalry that he could not replace. So Cowpens really did cripple him. They played cat and mouse across North Carolina until March. And in March, Nathaniel Greene, hoped to duplicate the Battle of Cowpens, to pull off a victory like that. It didn't quite work as planned, and they fought pretty much to a standstill.
Where are they now? Where are they? I mean,
they're just north of Greensboro.
So
where the park is.
So Cornwallis.
Battle of Guilford.
Even though Morgan and Greene's forces had defeated the British at Cowpens, the British were still on the move, trying to engage the American army and destroy it. I mean, they were the aggressors, I guess, at this point, even after
the battle. They certainly were, and Cornwallis still had that fine army. He was a good commander, and he had these really fine troops. It seemed inconceivable to him and to many other people that they couldn't defeat these ragtag militias and poorly trained soldiers. He was after Greene. Greene was pulling back and then turned to fight at Guilford Courthouse in March of 1781, hoping to achieve the kind of victory that Morgan had. Didn't happen quite that way, and yet he wreaked so much damage on Cornwallis's forces that Cornwallis could not really recover. He needed to get to the coast and be resupplied or evacuated by the British Navy and hurried straight from Guilford Courthouse to Wilmington.
Well, I hesitate to interrupt you because you just got a minute or two, but on the way he spent some time up here with us in Orange County.
He did, in fact, there's a Cornwallis road.
Yeah. So, I mean, he was in a hurry, but he stopped long enough to leave his mark. And General Greene left his mark, too, in Greensboro. And so
he did. There's a Greensboro in so many states honoring General Greene. Because he didn't have a cell phone or communication, Cornwallis could not contact the British Navy at Wilmington, so he then marched into Virginia and took Richmond and even took Charlottesville. But he was badly in need of being resupplied and reinforced, so he moved down the peninsula to Williamsburg and then to Yorktown. Now, General Lafayette, very young, I think about 24 years old, was operating in that area and more or less cut him off on the peninsula. Washington up in New York, and General Rochambeau, the French, had arrived. Washington and Rochambeau agreed.
I have to cut you off because you just about got us to the end, but the end comes and Cornwallis surrenders and the war is over. And the story that you told us shows us how that war was really won right here in North and South Carolina. And Robert Morton...
That was the beginning of the end in South Carolina and North Carolina. Cornwallis never recovered from Guilford Courthouse, really.
Thanks so much for sharing a piece of the story of the American Revolution and told by you so well, as best I've ever heard it. And I hope that you'll come back and we'll go through the whole battle at Guilford Courthouse and the trip to Wilmington and then back up to the surrender. Thanks, Robert Morgan.
Okay, my pleasure.
And thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.